We could be doing the minutes at any point, whenever the opportunity arises. And it is on the basis of that statement that I would like the agenda proposed for adoption. Thank you, Honourable Mhlobo, seconded by Honourable Khadebe. Right. And then we've got the apologies from Mr. Madima. Who are they?
Morning, members and guests. We don't have any apology, written apology or otherwise. Thank you.
I'm not sure if Yuli A seems to have a difference of opinion.
Chair, on the note that you have in front, Ms. Shlongwini will be arriving late. She has on top, right on top, you will see.
There is a written apology, Ms. Shlongwini. Honourable Shlongwini from the EFF will be arriving late. The members who appear to be missing at this point in time appear to be the Honourable Alberts and the Honourable Esterhazen. I'm not sure if Energy has a meeting, but we'll ask Mr. Hermans to clarify that. On this note, let us begin the program of the day. And as you can see there, we have become quite concerned on the issues around tariffs with respect to steel and with respect to sugar. Now, some of us will learn again today that you effectively have 1 year, it seems, one opportunity in the year for an application for a tariff review. We'll hear more about that. What we also want to know is we would like a clarification of information circulating that tariff-free sugar, duty-free sugar, poured into the country for 6 months. We would like that issue addressed. Coming back to the tariffs on steel, we need you to tell us what issues you took into account when you addressed the issue of tariff on the tariff application here. What is it that you took into account so that we have a better understanding? No, we are not trying to become protectionist at all. We are way below the waterline. But we are trying to ensure that our industries remain viable so that we are able to retain our workers in decent work. So as long as members understand that, we are going to start off with the DTI. I'm just trying to see who's going to start off then in DTI, because I see Ms. Nikki Kruger is not here. So who will be leading us? Oh, yourself, right. Is that Ms. Tandi Pele, Chief Director, IDD Capital Equipment and Metals? Fine, do go ahead.
Thank you so much, Honourable Chair. I will lead the discussion on the compensation on the steel industry, and I think you, taking true on what you have already indicated, what were the issues that were taken into account in addressing tariff protection in the steel industry. We're going to split the presentation between myself, as Tandi Pele, as the chair has already introduced me, and my colleague Omisha Naidu. We have taken the liberty to look at the broader issues affecting the steel industry so that we can have a common understanding on the kind of tariffs that we have already levied on the industry, both on the downstream and the upstream side, and what are we trying to address from a policy perspective. So I'm going to start off with the presentation. I think a couple of slides, a few slides, talks about putting the issues a bit into context. As honourable members would know, the steel industry globally continues to grapple with challenges. characterized by structural problems, persistent excess capacity, which are exacerbated by weak global economic recovery, subdued demand, causing huge negative activity impact on trade and employment. In recent times, there's been indication of modest improvement in terms of growth in the steel demand and recovery in prices from the historic lows that we have seen in 2015. However, this recovery remains uncertain due to mega trends associated with low steel intensity. As you know, the world is moving towards more recycling. There's huge issues on climate changes. There's issues of aging population and increased digitalization. Increasingly, we talk about this huge global overcapacity. The graph on the left-hand side indicates the gap between what we are currently producing as the world and the installed capacity. Already, with installed capacity that we have in the world, there's excess oversupply of more than 1.5 billion tons in the world. Capacity utilization across the world remains below 80%, although the 80%, if you look at it, you might think it should be sufficient to enable the steel industry to be competitive. However, this capacity utilization remains unevenly distributed between regions. Some regions are operating at 30% capacity utilization, some at 80% capacity utilization. So we need to get into a deeper understanding of what does this capacity utilization mean for different regional blocks. What has the global industry done in trying to address some of these excess capacity challenges? G20 Global Forum on Excess Steel Capacity has been formulated, led by OECD. As part of this intervention, we have seen a decline in capacity to about 2.2 million tons in 2017. However, as capacity is declining, as some parts of the world are decommissioning old plants that have become uncompetitive over time, we are also seeing new capacity additions that are coming on stream by 2020 to the tune of 45 million. There are 45 million tons. There's also new capacity that is in planning stages, mainly in the developing world, in India, in Vietnam, in the Middle East. Effectively, as we are talking about this excess capacity or overcapacity today, it's not an issue that we're going to be able to address in the near future, because the developing world, they are still seeing the need to develop more capacities to support development in their home countries. Which then leads me to the third point that I've already indicated. Many developing worlds or developing regions have similar views on how to grow their steel industry to increase their own capacities for domestic consumption due to the anticipated demand that is to come. The developing economies have developed a position paper which was presented at the G20 in 2018, which is led, South Africa is a participant into that process, led by India and Indonesia, to look at how do we better support the steel industry to enable development and to sustain jobs in our home countries. We have also seen large increases in the trade remedies measures to ensure that countries are introducing these trade remedies to also protect their own domestic capabilities. We have also seen increasing localization policies across the world to better support their own industries, which has somehow, one way or the other, have led to the contraction of the global steel trade. What has been the situation in South Africa? The effects of this global steel crisis are very evident across the value chains in South Africa, from mining to primary steel mills to domestic downstream manufacturers, which are continuously battling to compete to sustain jobs and to sustain investments. Some of the key challenges and the resultants thereof, as we know, we haven't really been growing at the optimum level. We're still having a low economic activity. With low economic activity, we have seen very slow growth in apparent steel consumption. We are faced with issues about high cost of production, aging plants and inefficiencies, which is backed by issues about lack of investment, maintenance and upgrades, which are leading to issues of lower capacity utilization and lower economies of scale. Coupled with those things, the resultant of those issues is that we remain less competitive in the global cost curve. We are faced with increasing cost base, cost of electricity, cost of logistics and rail, inefficiencies and cost of raw material. We have inconsistency in primary steel supply. We have seen reduced demand from mining to tooling to automotive applications. Downstream industry facing increased competitions against low price imports of finished products. So effectively, we are very squeezed as an industry from both the upstream and the downstream side. Then there's issues about access and the pricing of scrap metal to better support our mini mill industry and our foundry industry. As I've already indicated, the board has also introduced trade remedies such as, and I think my colleague will speak more on this, the U.S. Section 232, which is effectively limiting our ability to export into our traditional export markets. And with that, imports to those home countries such as the U.S. are being diverted into the South African market. In terms of capacity, from a South African point of view, the blue bar is indicating what is our installed capacity. The red bar are indicating the level of production that we have seen over time. And consumption. As you would see that our installed capacity has, our production levels have remained way below our installed capacity, with capacity utilization being estimated at about 50%. When we are operating at below, between 60 and 65% on average over the duration of the period that we are looking at. Low capacity utilization manifests itself into a number of areas. You become less competitive, your operational cost becomes relatively high, you are unable to actually even deal with issues of sustainability in the short to medium term. What has been the picture on imports of steel products coming to the country? In the top graph, you would see that imports overall for primary products coming to the country have significantly grown over the period, by more than 250% between 2000 and 2016. The proportional share of China into our import basket has increased by more than 54% over the same period. On the value-added products, which is the graph at the bottom, the value-added products, imports of value-added products have also increased significantly over the last 16 years into the country. Exports, primary exports to the region, you would notice that in the past we've been a relatively big exporter onto the African market. You would see that our relative contribution or our relative exports onto the African continent has also diminished with this. As the global steel crisis intensifies, our exports also on the African continent has also come down. Our exports of value-added products, even on the Africa overland, which is the graph on the right-hand side, has also gone down over the period. So we are squeezed in terms of domestic opportunities. We are squeezed in terms of export opportunities, and the African continent has been one of the biggest markets for our value-added products. With the global steel crisis intensifying, prices being depressed, countries such as China and India seeing more market opportunities into the African continent, we have lost our competitiveness. This graph demonstrates the Africa's crude steel production, which is the top graph, and then the numbers at the bottom is the steel used on the African continent. You see that from 2006, we used to produce over 18 million tons as a continent. Over time, up to 2015, that number has gone down to 13 million tons. However, one of the things that we also have to recognize is that Africa's demand of steel has relatively increased over the same period of time. So if you compare what is our production levels relative to our demand levels, there's still a huge opportunity for South African steel mills and value-added companies producing in South Africa to take the opportunity of the African market. The African market collectively consumes about 40 million tons per year, of which only 13 million of it is satisfied by the African steel capacity. So there's still about two-thirds of that regional demand that we can still take advantage of. If you look at the average steel use per capita, you realize that Africa as a continent, we still remain relatively low, and I think it is explained by the fact that we haven't really fully developed in terms of infrastructure. We haven't fully developed in terms of manufacturing capabilities. So if you compare ourselves to countries such as Turkey, countries such as China, there's still a huge gap, indicating that going forward there is an opportunity to actually increase steel demand on the African continent. What is the outlook? Sub-Saharan Africa is expected to grow to about 4%, or 4% growth is projected up to 2025, which is largely going to be driven by infrastructure investments, mining projects, oil and gas projects, and also the increased agricultural production and growing in services. There are key growing countries on the continent, such as Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, which are anchored by key projects, be it in the copper belt or the coal projects or the oil and gas projects, which effectively mean that there is a great opportunity for bigger projects coming on stream on the African continent, which is going to pull through the steel supply. The eastern part of Africa is forecasted to grow at about more than 6%, with as of indicating that projects such as the mining activities and oil and gas will pull through key products such as pipe and tubes, structural steels and wires. However, for us to be able to take advantage of this growing demand on the African continent, we need to improve our competitiveness, we need to improve our product diversification, we need to improve our product quality to be able to ensure that the strong supply competition that we are already facing on the African continent, we are able to tackle it head on. So I will stop here and let my colleague talk about some of the interventions we have already made to date to actually help the steel industry to better cope with the global issues that I've already indicated. And she will also touch on the issues of tariffs.
And Saad, your colleague is that Ms. Umisha Naidu?
right, Director
okay.
IDD.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and members. I will take you through the steel interventions that we've put in place since the onset of the crisis in 2015. Government established a task team led by the DTI, Economic Development, National Treasury, as well as the IDC, which intervened to save the industry from the threat of closure and loss of capacity. Some of the short to medium term measures that were put in place to support the industry include an increase in the rate of customs duty on primary steel products to 10%, safeguard measures for a period of 3 years on primary steel and as well as hot rolled coil and plate products, tariff increases on a range of downstream products and the deployment of rebates where products are not manufactured. And I'll take you through some of the slides which details these tariff increases and rebates. Then an agreement on a set of principles for flat steel pricing in South Africa with ArcelorMittal to ensure that it's priced appropriately so that steel independent industries are competitive while ensuring that the upstream steel mills remain sustainable. Government also introduced local procurement through the undealing of primary steel in designated products, as well as designation of downstream steel-intensive construction steel products and components. There's also the settlement of the Competition Commission issues with AMSA, establishment of a 1.5 billion steel development fund to support key downstream sectors, development of a short-term negotiated electricity pricing framework for energy-intensive users, investment support through 12i tax incentives, incubation support, scrap metal export tax proposal, and then a SARS reference price system being developed for downstream products. Then it was important to have an integrated set of both policy and industry reform measures, taking into account the interests of other players as well as the downstream industry. As I've indicated, principles were developed with reciprocal commitments, and there was consultation at NEDLAC, including with the downstream industry, led by the Minister of DTI and EDD. Some of the reciprocal commitments include investment and upgrading by ArcelorMittal, a pricing agreement, improving industrial output, job retention, and EBIT margin cap to ensure that the benefits are passed further downstream, and then transformation and developing black industrialists aligned to the BBBE codes. Enforcement and compliance, the ITAC tariff awards do include the commitments, as well as the Competition Commission settlement. Then in terms of local procurement, both primary and downstream industry have raised the need for increased local demand to drive economies of scale. Primary producers requested government to reconsider a public procurement of locally manufactured primary steel as input into designated steel products. So the steel crisis led to a review of the deeming of steel as one of the measures to support the industry. Revised instruction notes were issued for 7 products, steel-intensive products like solar water heaters, rail rolling stock, conveyance pipes, working vessels, and steel power pylons. And then additional designations of steel construction materials to support the downstream industry was issued in January 2017. This includes fabricated structural steel, wire products, roofing and cladding, frames and fasteners. Then in terms of the Downstream Industry Development Fund, National Treasury approved $95 million for Steel Development Fund over a 3-year period. The IDC, with its own funding, leveraged the allocation to approximately $1.5 billion. The key objective is to assist qualifying enterprises to improve competitiveness and assist companies in the sector that are in distress. Within the downstream steel industry, the following industries are targeted: foundries, fabricators, parts and component manufacturers, valve and pump manufacturers, and then capital equipment manufacturers. Then in terms of the downstream support measures, the DTI requested ITAC to lead a proactive investigation and review of downstream tariffs. This is a list of some of the tariffs that have been implemented and the findings. In terms of wire supplies and wire of of iron and non-alloy steel, the increase in tariff was implemented on the 31st of March, as well as for fasteners. And then in terms of prefabricated steel buildings, that was implemented in November last year. And then the steel ropes and stranded wire and cables, that is awaiting implementation, as well as gabions and wire nettings, that's been implemented in September last year, welded link chain products, grinding balls and media, also in September last year. And then in terms of the rebates, a number of companies have applied for rebates for steel that's not produced in the country, and this is in the appliance sector, in the structural steel, other bars and rods, as well as another list of hot rolled coils, as well as plate products that are not produced in the country. With effect from the 23rd of March 2018, President Trump imposed 25% duties on the imports of steel and 10% on aluminium, following a U.S. Section 232 report by the Secretary of Commerce that indicated that these products threatened to impair U.S. national security. The steel and aluminium products that were included in this investigation was Chapter 72, 73, and 76. The President proclamation giving effect to this also made country-based exclusions from these duties where a country reached an alternative means to address the threats with the U.S. South Africa made two submissions in this regard, requesting exemption, arguing that we do not pose a threat to the U.S. national security and to their steel and aluminium industries. We only account for 1.2% of total U.S. imports. We are a source of strategic primary and secondary products used in further value-added manufacturing, contributing to jobs in both countries. We offer to restrict exports to a quota based on 2017 levels. We also assured the U.S. that we had strict customs control measures to prevent circumvention and transshipment, and that South Africa had also introduced trade remedy measures to protect capacity and capability, and that we participate in the global forum to address steel excess capacity. However, despite these assurances, the U.S. Decided not to exempt South Africa from the duties. Countries that have been excluded include Argentina, Australia, Brazil, and South Korea. Just some information on the countries that have been excluded include Brazil, who agreed to a quota of 70% of its average finished steel exports to the U.S. Argentina agreed to a quota at 135% and aluminium exports at 100% of average exports to the U.S. South Korea would be limited to an annual quota, which is equivalent to about 70% of their annual average exports. Then the impact on the South African industry. South Africa's exporters would face competition from other exempted countries, as well as current and potential U.S. manufacturers. As per the Commerce Department report, the tariffs and quota will enable U.S. steel and aluminium production to utilize an average of 80% of their production capacity. It's expected that some U.S. companies will increase production and or new U.S. companies will also emerge. We will keep lines of communication open with the United States for any country exemption discussions in the future, and there will also be discussions in July at the AGOA Forum in Washington. Just in terms of the impacts on the different companies, with regards to steel, Deferco in Saldanha exports about 57% of their production to the U.S., and this could impact 400 direct jobs. For Longmore, in the pipe and tube industry. They are looking at 56 highly skilled direct jobs that could be affected. Columbus Stainless Steel, they produce a niche product for U.S. coal and rail car and bus industries. AMSA, seamless tube for oil and gas. AMSA will also be impacted in terms of their supply to Duferco and Hall Longmore. And then Cape Town Iron and Steel Works, which just started up. They were also anticipating exports to the U.S. Then in terms of aluminium, Uhleman, 25% of their sales are to the U.S. In terms of their supply of plate and coil for the automotive, construction, and aerospace industries. 300 direct jobs could be impacted, and then South 32, the Hillside smelter, 17% of production is to the U.S. The measures taken to mitigate the impact, there was several industry engagements led by the DTI minister, and the following actions of support have been identified. We are assisting companies to explore other markets with a focus on sub-Saharan Africa. Uhleman has already started this process. The mission in Washington is also assisting South African companies to engage U.S. buyers to apply for product exemptions in cases where the U.S. does not have the capacity and capabilities to supply. In many cases, South African suppliers supply a unique product that have been perfected over time to meet U.S. buyers' needs. And then there's also trade remedy measures to protect the local industry. Some aluminium products are not at the bound rate, and the industry will make applications to ITAC. The countries that have been exempted are subject to an absolute quota, and hence there is still an opportunity for our companies to export. We've also received information that some of the countries that have been exempted are not allowed to apply for the product exemptions. We will also continue our advocacy efforts with the U.S., focusing on trade and investment relations, South Africa's share of U.S. steel and aluminium imports, national security relations, and quotas. And then, as I've indicated, the minister will lead a discussion at the 2018 AGOA Forum, and NEDLAC constituencies have expressed an interest to participate. Then several countries, in particular India, China, and the EU, opened cases at the WTO dispute settlement body against the U.S. for violating WTO trade rules. The U.S. argues that their new tariffs on steel and aluminium are covered by GATT Article 21, based on national security. China, India, and the EU have argued that the U.S. Section 232 actions are safeguard measures, and on that basis have notified the Council for Trade in Goods that they would seek compensation. The U.S. has also launched a Section 232 on autos.
Go ahead. Thanks, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I think what the presentation demonstrates is a suite of interventions that government has taken to sustain and provide a path to grow and develop the steel industry, both on the upstream and the downstream side. Government has taken a decision that is important to actually preserve the entirety of the value chain. So it's not an either-or. It's not an upstream nor the downstream, it's both. It's important that we sustain the both in order to ensure that we are able to better support our infrastructure going forward, to be able to take advantages of the demand opportunities on the African continent, to be able to sustain the 190,000 odd jobs that are embedded in this value chain. So going forward, we're going to continue focusing on both demand and supply side interventions to ensure that we are able to really sustain and grow this industry going forward. The focus going forward, we're going to continue engaging on developing long-term policy program and project interventions. We want to develop a long-term strategy and a vision for the steel industry across the entire value chain with strong industry collaboration. We want to continue engaging SADC and the African Development Bank on steel intensive infrastructure projects to ensure that any level of demand on the African continent is satisfied and is able to, we are able to actually support our steel industry using that demand. On the South African side, on the demand perspective, we will continue embedding designations and ensuring that we improve on the monitoring and evaluation of the localization policy. We are in the discussion with colleagues from Mineral Resources to ensure that the mining charter also embeds localization as an objective of the charter going forward, or strengthen already what is already in the charter. There are issues, obviously, on the areas where the trade remedies that we have already implemented, i.e. the tariffs. There are still issues about the convention on implementation. In many tariff lines, there's a category called other, which in most cases is duty-free. There's been a couple of instances where there's been circumvention products that are declared under other to circumvent paying of the duty. There's also issues about misdeclaration at customs. We are in the discussion engaging with ITEC and SARS to look at ways that we can develop a reference pricing for on the downstream steel products. On the global front, we will continue to participate in the G20 to ensure that the corrective measures that are being implemented across the globe do not limit the policy levers to preserve and grow our primary steel capacity and our downstream activities, and do not also limit our ability to access the growing regional market in order to further entrench the capabilities that we have developed over time locally. And I think throughout the presentation we keep on raising the issues of competitiveness. We can only sustain the industry also improve its own competitiveness. So the key focus also going forward is to ensure that the industry also focuses on upgrading innovation and moving up the value addition to ensure that we are able to also develop new niche export products, and we are able to also take advantage of the regional construction and the mining projects to ensure that we sustain this capacity going forward. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you very much for that presentation. I noticed Ms. Nikki Kruger is here, the Chief Director, ITED Trade Policy and Negotiations. Thank you. But somebody whom I never saw until halfway through the presentation, I would like to acknowledge, and that is for EDD, Mr. Siyabulela Singiwe, Advisor to Minister Patel, who has been engaging on tariff measures. So well informed in that area. We have acknowledged SARS, have we not? Yes. So at this point in time, members have the opportunity to engage on the presentation, and we've got the Honourable Williams. I can't see who that hand is right at the top. The Honourable MacPherson, the Honourable McLaubel, the Honourable Kachalia, the Honourable Buyani, the Honourable Glanguini, the Honourable Whip, Honourable Khadebe. In that order, shall we start? Essentially, trying to keep to the substance in a maximum of 3 minutes, if possible. All right? Let's...
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I've got a few questions. On slide 10, it talks about two-thirds of the regional demand is supplied by importers. I just want to know, why aren't we just jumping in there and dealing with that, because it seems that there is the demand, because the demand doesn't seem to be locally. Also on slide 13 and slide 14, there doesn't seem to be much on the side of productivity and competitiveness, even though you said so at the end. But for instance, on slide 14, I'd like to know the reciprocal commitments, investments and upgrades, pricing, how much of this has been done? You've just listed it here, but it seems to me that The steel industry basically didn't invest in themselves, didn't upgrade anything, and is now coming and crying to government about, well, America's tariff duties. What have they actually done to promote their own industry? It seems that this is a serious lack here of competitiveness and productivity, and I just want to know, there's no measure here. It doesn't tell us what they've actually done for the money we've spent on them. And also I'd like to know, how much money has the state spent on the steel industry in totality? Is it worth it for us? I know you're saying that there's 190,000 jobs, and I understand all of that. But if the industry itself is not doing anything and just expecting government to step up to the plate for them, I'd like to know what you think about that. What is the industry doing to promote themselves? Thank you.
Thank you. Can we have Honourable MacPherson?
Thank you very much. I think it's important to take a trip down memory lane and understand how we got to where we are today, Chair. Because in 2016... there was an agreement between ArcelorMittal and the DTI to allow for tariffs to protect them against imported steel products that were coming mainly from China. In return for that protection, they had to, as Honourable Williams had alluded to, had to meet a number of agreements, including not increasing their pricing, investing in their infrastructure, so on and so forth. And I don't know, between now and today, when they have actually once met any of those agreements. They have unilaterally increased prices between up to 22% between then and today. They, I don't know what they have done in terms of their upgrading, their job retention, improving industrial output. And then, so to me it seems like government has been prepared to protect an uncompetitive, monopolistic company in nature at the expense of the downstream industry. Now, what you don't differentiate is where those 190,000 jobs are located, of which 170,000 are in the downstream sector. So that has got to be one of the biggest focuses of the DTI, of how to protect the downstream industry and make them more competitive. Because over the years, since 2016, they have actually started importing steel products, ready-made components, because it's cheaper for them to import them than it is for them to buy ArcelorMittal's shoddy B-grade steel that they are forced to pay up to 22% more than they can get it from anywhere else in the country. And then the minister tells us that they've gone and developed a downstream development fund. But that downstream development fund only came into existence in the 2017-2018 financial year, nearly 18 months after they started paying more for steel products than they should have had to. And so there seems to be this unequal balance between ArcelorMittal, that seems to me to get preferential treatment, that has that gets to determine its pricing in a so-called pricing committee. We still don't know how many times that has met in the last 2.5 years.
Right.
And at the expense of the downstream sector. Now, I haven't seen one downstream operator who says that they think that the DTI is doing a great job to assist them and to protect them. The only people that think the DTI is doing a good job is ArcelorMittal. And that tells me, Ms. Kruger, that something is very, very unequal in this process. And I still can't get to the bottom of how we continue to go down. So I look forward to hearing from you, and I'll have some more questions on my second round.
Thank you very much, Honourable MacPherson. Before the next member of the committee comes in, I would just like to request that the... I know we've got people, PMG, we've got journalists, etc., and if they could be, as I see one of the journalists are right behind me, Ms. Linda Ensa,
if you could be more or less there, and those from PMG or wherever, just on that back row looking forward. And then we'd ask the SAFTA members of that community to refrain from sitting in this row on this side of the aisle. There are just three of you here. So if the three of you would please just come across to this side here, please. No, not the back row. Yourselves, yes. Three. Because we're not sure how many other members of Parliament could arrive as well, and we need to have space for them as well. I hope everyone understands that. Fine. Green happens to be my favourite colour, even in the middle of winter. Anyway, we then had, after the Honourable MacPherson, the Honourable McLaughlin.
No, thanks, Honourable Comrade Chair. I think, Chair, we will probably need more time because the topic is more specific and is more of a knee-jerk reaction to deal with the question of tariffs. But there are fundamental issues about the industry itself. Very fundamental what the industry is doing and what are we doing as government. Because there are fundamentals that we needed to do. One of the issues that probably on the technical issues for the team when they go back, because there is an incoherence in the slides. I'll quickly go to the incoherence, Comrade Chair. Firstly, there is a slide that talks to South African situation. These numbers, Comrade Chair, it's number six. Okay, thank you. It's number six. You see, the slide is explicitly telling you what are the challenges, very high-level challenges, and what are the results. And we are missing in the slide what are the high-level mitigation measures. If you think that you have your mitigation measures, go and look at the slide that talks to steel intervention. There is no correlation between the two. And the issue that we are raising on this slide number six, they are so fundamental. So fundamental that if we had mitigation measures, we would have then be in a position to start to engage. One of the issues we are raising is around low economy. The other one is around cost of productivity, age plans, inefficiencies. And if we had put other issues around what they've done around asset management, when productivity was high, profitability was high, and so forth, we could talk. But this information is actually missing. I will not even attempt to go there because I will take longer than that. Then the issues that you are raising technically on this page is still intervention. As I was saying to you, there is no correlation. Then you go to another technical matter. Well, I'm happy with regard to slide number 22, where we are referring to the situation in the U.S. I could see that slide is not finished until you read the slide with slide number 25. It could have been much nicer to be so closer to each other. But when you look at slide number 25, there is an inconsistency. I'm happy that the industries that are being affected, they are clearly defined. In certain instances, the tonnage is defined, in certain instances, no. In certain instances, the number of jobs that are going to be impacted, yes or no. Then we'll go to another last technical matter before the fundamental one. Is the one, Comrade Chair, on page 28. I'm very happy with the elucidation of the high-level next steps that need to be taken. They look to be very strategic. But in as much as they are strategic, they raise fundamental issues, special number one. If we are going to develop a long-term strategy now, you mean over the last 24 years, and then in the time before, there are other issues. But later on, probably we need to discuss, do we understand our strength? Remember our natural endowment of chrome, iron ore, and manganese, that are the components of steel. What is the what are you talking about, export and import in terms of those ones, and what is our strategy going forward? But we'll come back on the second round. I thought, let me just be able to say that in as much as you want to deal with these issues, but the coherence should be very important to be raised.
I think those points are well made there. Let us turn to Honourable Floorball. We had Honourable Buyani. Sorry, just one moment. Buyani.
No, thanks, Chair. Mine, I think, few clarity-seeking questions. Because you can see here, I just wanted to check my name. Who owns this company that we're talking about, and also their status in terms of local procurement, localization, and the triple BEE. And also, how are they assisting in terms of the triple P challenge, like your job creation, poverty, and inequality? I can see there are some turnaround strategy in dealing with the challenges raised above. But to me, they are not clear. Because here in the slide, I don't know what the slide, but this page, or it's number 3, domestic data, SA capacity. The major cause of decline is cheap steel import, which adversely affects the profitability and capacity utilized rate of the domestic steel produce. I think that is not enough. I think we need more clarity on this one in terms of their investigation. And also, I wanted to check in terms of a coordination between government entities to deal with these challenges raised above.
You mind raising your voice or adjusting the mic? One of the two.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, as I indicated earlier on, Chair, to say, they said the South African steel industry has been in constant decline since 2010. And you can see since 2000, there's an increase in imports from China of 12%. Can we be clarified here as to what's really happening here, Chair? The production vis-a-vis the demand level and the manufacturing capabilities. And also the loss of South African primary steel production. Chair, last, I think it's on page 'steel intervention, local procurement by government, and deeming of primary steel is designated product requiring the use of local manufacturing. Can we be clarified the indicators in terms of local manufacturing, in terms of percentage, how much, and are we winning, or what are the challenges? Because going straight to tariffs cannot be able to assist the industry. Let us check what are the challenges in the industries. How can we best deal with dealing with challenges before we can talk of tariffs, Chairperson? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honourable
Buyani.
Honourable
Pichania. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a number of questions. Notwithstanding the U.S. Extreme and selective protectionist measures which it's taken, which requires ongoing engagement, clearly, I'd like to know, firstly, what protectionist measures and why did we take prior to this over a 5-year period prior to the ArcelorMittal accommodation that was made. So I want to understand in this industry what protectionist measures we took. And secondly, what ire that raised, if it did, which I'm sure it did, amongst other WTO signatories. Thirdly, I'd like to know our investment governmental investment and other direct and indirect investment into this industry, how did this, if at all, boost the local industry? What figures do we have to show that? And thirdly, in line with that, perhaps you have some figures on exactly how much was spent directly and indirectly over that five-year period on the steel industry. This will help us evaluate and formulate further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Kachadia. Honourable Flanguini.
Thank you very much, Chair. Mine is straight on page 14, because I'm covered partly by the Honourable Williams in some of his submissions, so I won't ask those questions again. On the transformation of the BBBE codes and good practice, if we can get specific numbers pertaining to that, and how is the department going to transform this specific industry and how far it has got. Because simply to put it there doesn't give us any hope, because we know of very other industries that we just throw the word transform but nothing happens. So I would just like to know on that one. And then on page 15, I'm covered by Honourable Briani. I've spoken about the number 2 of the primary producers having to request government to consider public procurement. It's still odd for me that your primary producers have to sort of beg government to do their own policies or improve on their own policies. And because localization is a government policy, so if you are reminded each and every time to sort of reflect on your policies, it's quite odd. And one also needs to see, Chair, in this industry, that you are not only reliant on almost, you give the big players the bulk of the cake, and then your small players, you just throw us the scrums and stuff like that. And then on page 25, the presentation went nicely to say to us, this is how many jobs is going to be lost in this particular company, 456, and then to the others, no figures. I would like to also reflect those and see those figures so that we can know where this 100,000 job losses is going to come from, because now it's not formulating as to how many jobs are going to be lost in this specific companies. And then the Honourable Buyani has spoken to it as to indicate to us who is owing the owners of these companies and also the BBBE component in these companies, so that we can know that as well, Chair. Page 28, and I'm moving very fast because you said we are stick for time. Page 28 on the next step. The one lady, I came late, Chair, so I didn't catch the names and positions of individuals, so I might be wrong. The one lady spoke about the monitoring and evaluation procedures and stuff like that for localization. So what I would like to know, how you're going to monitor and which steps have you currently already put in place to monitor that this on your localization aspect in the company. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I'd like to just touch on the issue of the South African situation. When you speak about aging plants inefficiencies, what are the causal factors of this inefficiency? Is it a matter of
unskilled labor, cost of capital, or sheer negligence. What is it because it is inefficient? Because when you speak about a commodity like steel, which is central to the growth of the economy, you will have expected that there will be a high level of planning which will be involved. Number two, Chair, I think that what also we raised previously in our previous life, because this thing is not coming in for the first time, we spoke about the issue of the mini mills, the mini steel mills, which you spoke about. Because as you said, Chair, that we've got all the ingredients needed in South Africa to manufacture steel. We've got a chromium, a manganese, or tin, all those things are here. But you find that the steel price still becomes uncompetitive. What makes it to be like that? Because there's something wrong somewhere. So I think that they must elucidate clearly what is it. Because we hammered that in the previous parliament. I think it's still almost like facing the same thing as it was during that time. And then on the issue of the tariff measures which are imposed by America, you know very well that when you participate in AGOA, there are certain deals we had to make. There are certain concessions which we had to make. Take, for example, the issue of the poultry industry. A lot of concessions were made by South Africa. Is AGOA, I'll ask the Department of Trade, is AGOA still worth the paper it is written on, as we are speaking now? Because if they are going to have tariffs on our steel and even also on the automotive sector, and then it's questionable. But the last one, Chair, will be the issue of the Africa we want, Agenda 2063. In Agenda 2063, I think that the African countries actually decided that they'll try to be self-sufficient, trade among themselves. But from what we're seeing here is that South Africa itself is being displaced by its own BRICS partners, China and India in the African continent. So what did the department do in order to have that coordinated strategy so that we protect the African continent?
Thank you. Thank you very much for confining yourself to the time. Honourable Mantash.
Chairperson, thank you and good morning. I have one question, Chairperson. I want to understand from DTI what is their long-term strategy to protect South African industry. Because for me, it looks like we are not proactive, but we react to crises. This is not the first one. What have you been doing over the time? This is not the only industry that is in a dire situation. What is your long-term strategy to protect the interests of South African industries?
I just want to perhaps guide the discussion and the questions. The reason steel was put on the agenda and sugar was they have something in common, the tariff issue. That is the purpose of this engagement. It is not the entire steel industry. The whole issue is that we do need to engage with steel in depth. This is not the meeting for that. I didn't want to cut anyone short. But if we don't get back on board to the purpose, we asked for this meeting 2 months ago. We said we must get a better understanding of the impact of tariffs. Can tariffs be used with steel, with sugar, with what, to ensure that it supports our industry, supports jobs, etc. How can we use this instrument of tariffs, this measure? Or is it such a blunt instrument? And that is the purpose. We've dealt with admin prices in steel. We've dealt with X and Y. We have not dealt specifically with steel, not with steel, with tariffs. So we have got, it may seem a long day, but when we look at what we are trying to achieve, we've still got to deal with the sugar tariffs. We've still got to get an input from ITAC on tariffs. So what I'm going to do, so that at least we ensure that the issues that you have raised
can be addressed, let's address them. But then remember, this specific meeting is on tariffs per se. So I will ask the department to address the questions they've raised. Some may have to come back in writing. But we are going to get into the focus of the tariffs. All right. Thank you very much. Honourable MacPherson, I don't want a long engagement, but let me allow you to put your point on the table.
You see, Chair, I'm happy to have that discussion because it seems like there's two sets of standards when it comes to tariffs. The department jumps at tariffs to protect the steel industry, but drags its feet to protect the sugar industry on employing tariffs. So, I mean, when do we have that robust in engagement?
No. That's why I said we want to focus on tariffs. But I'm going to allow just these couple of hands I saw, like Honourable Tlangwini, Honourable Matlobo, and then I want the responses, please, on the issues raised. Honourable Tlangwini.
Thanks, Chair. Notwithstanding to what you have just said and what the Honourable MacPherson have said on the tariff issue, I think, Chair, we got a presentation and we were engaging the presentation on what they have put in the presentation. I think there was nothing that we have asked them that is not set in this presentation. So I think, in all fairness, since they are here, they need to answer to our question. And if anything needs to be coming back in writing, as you have said, they can come back to us in writing. But I think we have engaged the presentation what they have given us. So I think they should answer.
That's why I thought, well, somewhere something's gone wrong. But let us not turn it into fruitless expenditure. So they will respond to the issues raised. Honourable McLaughlin.
Chair, that's why I chose not to get into substantive issues, because of the quality of the presentation. Remember, if you deal with the question of tariff, this is not for the first time. Tariff is an instrument either to actually do protection or do a certain kind of recovery. And some of us with our little experience in other work, I've seen the input when tariff has to be made either to protect an industry or to regulate certain things. The information that is being presented here is not sufficient to say, come closer, why do you want to come to that? For an example, Comrade Chair, when I raised the issue about the challenges raised, one issue Comrade Carter managed to make a follow-up. Someone is talking about an asset that has aged, that has a number of issues, is one thing that you actually take into consideration if you are going to do a tariff determination. Then there are others around issues of economy, issues around the market. And if someone does not package the information closer to say, why do you want to do a protectionism? Or why do you want to actually cover yourself? And you become so general. Normally they use technical data to actually come to say, is this tariff reasonable? And then even if the tariff has been set, you ask yourself the question, who's going to bore the brand? And who's actually going to cushion the most vulnerable? But the presentation that we received was not closer to that thing to say, if what actually because is being triggered by the decision by the US government to do certain things or not, is more general issue. I hope that probably we'll have more closer to issues so that at a technical level we can be very incisive. What are these imperatives? What is this empirical data? And what is going to be the impact? Then we can be able to say we are able to cushion our own. And is for how long?
Now, DTI, will you please respond? The questions were raised in terms of the presentation. Please respond.
Thanks, Chair. I will start. I think on the... Maybe let me start off by indicating why did we structure the presentation as it is. Right? We did it this way in order to give the committee a sense of the interventions that as the DTI and EDD, or broadly as government,
we have deployed to assist the steel industry to cope with the crisis. There's a different process that IPAC normally undertakes in determining or in deciding on the level of tariff to be put on a particular tariff line. There's a whole lot of investigation that talks into the technical data on, you know, how did we arrive to the decision that we have arrived to. The intention of the presentation was just to give a sense of what are the interventions already being deployed to assist the industry. And I thought, let me start off with that kind of a premise to indicate, as I was saying in my presentation, that...
Allow us to continue.
Yes.
Right?
Continue. As I indicated in my in our presentation, to say it was necessary to deploy both supply and demand side interventions. Tariff is one of the instruments to assist us in getting better in our supply interventions. As we demonstrated in the presentation, there are huge issues in terms of our ability to supply and our ability to actually capture the demand. Hence, there's a switch in the demand side and then the switch in the supply side interventions. And I think maybe going into some of the issues that have been indicated, Honorable Lewis, you had indicated that, yes, through the regional demand or the African demand supersedes the kind of capacity that we are deploying as an African continent, South Africa, Egypt being the biggest two producers of steel. There is huge opportunities to actually really supply greater product range, to supply the infrastructure projects that are happening on the African continent. Hence, one of the interventions that we are seeing going forward, we need to better package project funding going to the African continent to better understand the product needs so that the mills in South Africa are able to actually produce products that are needed to satisfy this demand. The demand is great. I mean, two-thirds of the African demand is still being satisfied by the imports, be it from the Far East, be it from India, be it from even the developed world. I think it's in the nature in which we are packaging projects, enabling participation of South African companies into this mega project onto the African continent. In terms of the, I think I will jump around on the questions. I will necessarily follow the same line. I think the suite of interventions demonstrate that we are conscious of the need for the industry to actually improve their competitiveness. The bigger part of the interventions that have been put on the table is to actually enable the downstream industry to be more competitive. The interventions that we have made on the upstream side, mainly it's been on the tariff protection on the upstream products, be it in the form of the 10% duty on hot roll coil or ranges of primary product lines, and the safeguard duties on hot roll coil and plate. And the justification thereof was that we need to preserve the capabilities that we have in the country in order to ensure that we are able to better support the downstream industry and to be able to better support our infrastructure needs. Yes, the bigger part of the 190,000 jobs that I've spoken about, majority 170 or so, are definitely in the downstream industry. Hence, the bigger suite of the interventions that are being put forward is to actually ensure that the downstream industry becomes competitive. We've introduced tariff measures on a number of downstream lines, ranging from structural steel to pipes to fasteners, to ensure that the industry is also able to cope with the imports. And I mean, one of the things that we are probably we are not seeing very clearly in the presentation is that the prices at which finished goods come into the country are way relatively low, very, very low, that even with a, sometimes with a 30% duty levied on the downstream product is not necessarily sufficient to cushion the industry. So we need a suite of interventions. Hence, as government, we have taken the decision to say where government is buying value-added products, i.e. pipes, i.e. structural steel, we will designate those primarily to ensuring that
government projects are satisfied with government or with South African capacity and not necessarily with imports. But as the members would know, designation only works with public expenditure. It doesn't cover what the private sector can do to actually promote localization. That requires a different kind of a conversation. We have signed the procurement accord with the private sector. However, the demand from the private sector has not really forthcoming to enable the industry to actually improve their economic state. So we are very conscious of the fact that the support has to be equal or not greater on the downstream side. The Downstream Development Fund is primarily mainly to focus on improving the competitiveness of the downstream industry. The tariff protection, we have levied the number of tariffs, we have increased the duties up to the boundaries on the number of downstream products to ensure that they do remain competitive. Designation is solely on the downstream products, which then takes me into the probably providing clarity on the deeming. In the first round of designation, 2012, I think that's the first round of designations that came on stream, there was a decision to deem even imported steel as local to enable, because government generally we buy value-added products, we don't necessarily buy the primary steel. But in the making of the value-added products, you do need the primary steel in order to get to the price, right? So, in the first round of the designation, we had said that even imported steel can be used in the government infrastructure project as long as the value-added products are made in South Africa. That decision was then reversed in 2015, 2016 to ensure that we are, when the crisis hits the upstream industry, to ensure that we are able to give a bit of demand to also our primary mills, we then took the decision to remove the deeming clause to ensure that the public expenditure gives full support to the entirety of the value chain, not necessarily only the downstream part.
Yes, can I just assist you? We'll be here till 9 o'clock tonight, the way you are going. The focus is tariffs. Yes, there were some questions raised here. Address the questions succinctly. You used an explanation on value addition. It took you 2 minutes. Just that one issue. One word, one phrase. Please, we do not have 6 hours for you. You have got about 5 minutes left. Now please proceed.
Thank you. Actually, I'm not sure that any of the questions are actually being answered, to be perfectly frank.
I mean,
one of the very pointed questions that were put about the reciprocal commitment, I mean, you haven't spoken about it. You haven't actually told us how many of those reciprocal commitments have been made. Sorry, you need to direct yourself to the chair, not to me. And I have a problem with the line of answering that's taking place. They must either answer it directly, or they must come up with something else. But it's just purely not acceptable.
Now, Honourable MacPherson, that is why I intervened. In a way, you strengthened the point I made, but let us just persuade the Chief Director from DTI, I think it's Ms. Pele, please focus. We can no longer have this fragmented response.
Honourable Chair, if I can respond on the reciprocal commitments question. AMSA have made a commitment in terms of the Competition Commission settlement as well as in terms of their commitments with respect to the primary steel tariff. In terms of investment, it's a 4.6 billion rand investment over 5 years. They have complied with that commitment, so it started in 2016, and over the two-year period, they have made various investments on the primary steel in terms of the equipment upgrading and on the primary steel production process. In terms of pricing, they have complied with the basket and the international past it in terms of the pricing agreement. International prices have gone up over the period, and the basket is based on international prices.
Honourable Williams, you had an intervention.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that the reciprocal question should be answered in writing to this committee with a full everything that's been given and everything that they've done, and it must be completely very comprehensive, a response in writing. And I think perhaps all of the answers should come now in writing. I don't think we should continue hearing these. I think everything that was asked should come in writing. Thank you.
Right. Honourable Planguini.
Thanks, Chair. I fully agree with Honourable Williams, because we are not getting all of the answers properly. Because if I were to go on to what the Chief Director have answered back to me, it's clearly stating, or in all of the answers that she has said, there's no enforcement for localization, like, at all. Where private sector can do whatever they want to do, if I were to take what she has just answered. Answered back. So I think they need to go back and form for us a constructive answer on all of the things that we have asked. And also, Chair, there needs to be consequences. That departments need to learn this, that if they are coming to a committee, we don't want this wishy-washy, and that is why they take members of parliament sometimes for granted. Because they think they can come here and give us wishy-washy answers, and then we must just take it as such. This is now going straight to fruitless and wasteful expenditure, because they didn't come here and give us what we wanted. So there must be consequences in this regard, Chair, going forward. We don't have time to waste. We are quarter to 2019 elections, and we want to see some of these things done before we leave Parliament. Some of us want to leave a legacy behind and see industries transform, not this wishy-washy. We don't have time to waste.
Now, look, I'm going to have to make a ruling at this point, because, you see, I looked several times at my agenda, you know, thinking, well, I wonder what the comrades have done to my brain. But it is definitely, you must have been informed that this was about tariffs, the impact, the role it plays in steel and sugar. Now, that is not your presentation, per se. It is not focused. You know, it's, well, some have described it as a little incoherent. Now, the issue is this. When I see members of your generation there, I'm hoping you're going to be learning. You know, if we make a mistake, yes, but you have to learn from that. It is seldom I send a department away or a division in a department to come back again because you're wasting our time. I think I've only done that 3 times in 25 years. So really, this is a waste of a committee's time. Having said that, we do have ITAC here, all right? We also have a member of DTI who can talk on other issues in this regard. So what we're going to do, just as a sort of breath of fresh air, is to have ITAC at this point in time, and maybe that little bit of a breeze rolling through Parliament may assist us all. So we're going to just hear from you. Please, the subject is simply this. It's sugar, steel, the tariff issue. Tariffs on that. That's what we're talking about. Otherwise, arguably, sugar and steel have nothing in common. So the person who's going to be speaking on ITAC here is Mr. Nzimande, and also EDD here. Hello? Where are the two of you? Right. Can you start for ITAC, please, Mr. Nzimande? Please. Chief Dunn Commissioner there. Are you ready?
In just one moment, Honourable Chairperson. morning, honorable members. Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, members in the gallery. Thank you for the opportunity. And thank you as well for the succinct direction that you have given us in terms of our presentation. What I will do, honorable Chairperson, is to, in my presentation, focus on only those slides that speak to what you have directed us. It might also perhaps be convenient to start with steel and then move to sugar so that we carry on from the previous presentation. In my presentation, steel appears on page, starts from slide 10.
You have to get the
It's halfway through. The numbers appear in red at the bottom, and they're on the green section of the slide.
Well, there we are. He works in the traffic department. Let us just proceed.
Yes.
Tariff support given to the upstream steel industry.
Yes.
Once you've done that, I want you to pause. I want EDD to come and then on steel. And then we'll do agriculture after that, so there's no confusion. So ISAC will be speaking purely to the tariff on the steel at the moment.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. The slide before you lists the type of products and the companies in respect of which tariffs were having in place or were put in place between the period 2015 and 2016. The range of products which my colleague from DTI had previously mentioned include galvanized coated steel, wire rod steel, reinforcing bar, structural steel, semi-finished steel. I won't go through the list. Let me finish with let me just take one step back. There are two important things that I need to mention about the tariffs that we give or that we gave in respect of primary steel. The first one is that there have been ordinary customs duties, and those are subject to a bound rate that the WTO that South Africa is committed to under the WTO. They range generally between 10% and 15%. Those would be ordinary customs duties, and they are imposed generally based on the policy that we get from the DTI. And then the second set of duties are called trade remedy duties. Those enable South Africa to go beyond the bound rate, and in this regard, we have imposed safeguard duties on hot rolled products to the tune of 12%. So on hot rolled products, we've got two sets of duties. One, ordinary customs, which was 10%, that's the bound rate, and another, on top of that, 12% as a safeguard duty. In exchange for that protection, AMSA made the following commitments. That it will commit to a pricing mechanism which is being monitored by a steel committee. That it will invest 4.6 billion, of which a certain amount, as we speak, has already been invested on particular lines in AMSA's production, and I'm happy to give the specific lines, Chairperson, but because the report, the information is confidential, I won't give the exact quantum. Dubbed by way of...
Sorry,
can I just say that again? Of which report is confidential, Chair?
Oh,
like, on, so that we...
Yeah. What report were you referring to, or was it the figures?
Yes, Chairperson, thank you. Thanks for the question. As a result of this, the intervention of the steel, there's a steel committee that has been established. That committee has met twice and has issued reports, has issued two reports, one of which is still to be finalized. So the information that we have put together here extracts the contents of those reports in a manner that we hope is relevant for this purpose. And we have to, as I explained earlier, to respect the confidential contents of that report. So I will not, in terms of the exact amount of money that has been invested in respect of each item that is itemized in the list.
For the moment, we'll seek clarity on this ourselves.
Yes.
Because you are, on the one moment, you're sharing this with Parliament per se. I was not informed that we would get anything of this nature, because then we could have considered a closed committee meeting. But I was not informed of this. I can hardly call this a closed committee meeting now, as we sit here with other members of the public present. So it has put us in somewhat of a difficulty. So I will address that as soon as the committee secretary returns. I don't want to raise it in full discussion, Honourable McPherson, because we will come back to it. Is it not on this issue?
Chair, I just think at this juncture I'm becoming increasingly uncomfortable with how this meeting is progressing this morning on these particular issues. We are being told that we cannot have information of a report that comes from a pricing committee that is established effectively through government duties to protect a steel manufacturer. I have a big problem with that. You know, this is Parliament. We have a right to that information. If ITAC should have disclosed that before coming to this committee, and we could have made that decision. They are now blindsiding us by telling us, well, they can't actually tell us what's in that report. And I think it's fundamentally misleading as to how we are progressing in this meeting. And it's becoming very frustrating when we're trying to get critical information and we're being told at every turn we can't answer a question, we can't give you information. And I really would ask, Chair, at this juncture that you rule on how we proceed with this meeting.
Other hands up, and I will take the whip last. Okay, Honourable McLaubo, Honourable Clanguini, Honourable Hadebe.
No, thanks, Chair. I think you are correct that you should have been notified, and probably the man interpret. You just have to assist us. Your document that you have circulated is not even classified to a level of confidentiality. Whether there is something you want to classify now, or if in the presentation, in the context, there is nothing of classification, I think you can give that clarity so that we can proceed. But if there is an information that I take for sensitivity because of competition and so forth when you are responding, you can be able to indicate during the course of that question and answer, or certain information that has not been finally been processed, because there are certain information that gets to come to you that you need to process. Ultimately, a decision has not been made. We can't then use information that has not arrived at a decision-making process. Then it becomes duly authorized to be made public.
Thank you, Honourable Member Warbell, for reading.
Thanks, Chair. You know what I have a problem with, Chair? It's the fact that all of a sudden we hear a report is confidential. One. Two, I think when those reports have been finalized, as the Honorable Mahlobe have mentioned, that report needs to be made public. And it's the nature of clumsiness that I have spoke about earlier on, Chair, that when departments or entities come here, they think they can just clumsily throw words and it becomes fine like that. We continue. And that is what is happening here this morning. We are getting nothing. Some of us have cancelled other meetings that we needed to attend to, and then to come and sit and listen to such clumsiness. It can't continue on like this, Chair. And these departments must take full responsibility, and there must be consequences for this clumsiness. We can't leave it like that. The people just throw, no, this is confidential, and that is, you can't have it. Then don't even mention it until such point you have done your steps in order to make a report public. You should know that by now in the office that you are holding. You just don't throw words like that.
You have certainly stated a valid point there, Honourable Plangwini. Quite right, we should have been informed beforehand. Honourable Khadebe, the whip of the committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that I'll have to concur with my colleagues that we are in a dicey situation where we are now. But the issue is how do we proceed moving forward. I think that's the crux of the problem. I think that whatever is confidential, whatever is not yet for public consumption, it must be removed from the report so that we cannot have follow-ups of that. But then if that part, you say that it must be removed and it is going to affect us in taking the decision forward, then we'll have to reschedule the meeting for some other time then, so that the proper procedures can be followed. Because if we are aware, as you said, that this thing is confidential, we have to apply it for this thing to be in common, to be in common, so that the public cannot have that information firsthand. But if they cannot remove those things which they think that are confidential, then we have a problem moving forward.
I think ITAC has heard the committee members, and I'm sure you would be the first to acknowledge this was not the right approach, just arriving here and informing us. You see, once you get to Parliament, this institution then prevails, the decisions here. And as Chair, it remains with me to make any ruling in this regard within the rules of Parliament. And the rules of Parliament are not unconstitutional. We take sensitive matters, perhaps that's the word that one to describe them, but I don't know why we seem to be learning things for the first time in this meeting. You should have known that you should have contacted the chairperson in this regard so that we could manage this. Now, you wish to respond?
Please, Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. Members, I do apologize for that. Can I just make perhaps a couple of things clear. The first one is that the presentation as we have it does not contain confidential information, so it is a public document. The information that I sought to share in respect of the spend is that my colleagues had mentioned that 4.6 billion had been committed to by the applicants. We've got the breakdown of how some of that money have been spent, and I'm able to say, perhaps in a manner that is non-confidential, that of the 4.6 billion that was committed to,
1.6 billion has been spent, which represents 35% of the total amount. But I would have been able to break it. It is broken down into where was spent what, which is the confidential part that I would like to keep out. That's the first thing. The second thing which I would like to clarify is that my colleagues sit on the steel committee, and that is why we have access to certain information that is still part of the deliberation of that committee, which, however, is not ready for public consumption. So what I am doing is to share some of that information in a non-confidential manner. The report that I'm talking about is actually a draft report which has still not been adopted by the committee. I'm just sharing some of the information that is there. So based on that, the heart of the information there is that in respect of the 4.9 billion commitment, only 1.6 billion has to date been invested. And that's basically what I sought to communicate. Nothing beyond that.
I'm quiet because I'm looking at my rules. Yes, the reality is this, that we, as we sit here now, it would be difficult to call a closed meeting of the committee in which this could be fully shared. And I think it may be pertinent for us to take a point you have expressed here and shared with us, Honourable Hadebe, that there may be certain presentations and information we would have to reschedule for after July. So it means that we can certainly get something from yourselves on the steel. I shall be writing a letter to you and for your principal. I assume that your specific title is commissioner. Is that not right?
That's right.
So effectively, other than the minister, you are the head of ITAC, as it were. So in that capacity, I shall write to you, and you need to know that before you come here again, to ensure all the material you've got, all our meetings are open to the public. Unless there's a particular reason, and there are rules governing that. I can't just decide, yes, it'll be a closed meeting. I can't just do that. There are certain factors and issues that are taken into account. So you will need to respond in that manner on the information you believe you are unable to share in an open meeting. But we want to know how any budget is spent, for that matter, Parliament. We pass the budget. This is the entity that does that, the institution. So what we will do is you will just complete the presentation you are making on steel. And I don't want to hear the words like, and this is confidential. You will then be coming back to us to explain at length. So try to be brief, knowing that you will be returning. Just raise the principles here today. That it's not acceptable, and I do need, if a DG was here, I'd be expressing that. You are a commissioner, you're an incredibly senior person, and I express that to you. It is not appropriate that a committee in the economic cluster is not able to process a meeting constructively. We are wasting time as we sit here. Please continue. Briefly now. I'm going to give you 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chairperson. The next slide that I would like to draw your attention to is slide number 14, which shows the product in respect of which we have given the, or that in respect of which duties have been imposed. I will not again go in detail through that, save to say that the duties range between 10% and 20% that have been imposed, on the various products. Where duties that have been imposed affect certain categories of products which are not locally manufactured, a mechanism has been created for parties to apply for a rebate of that duty, and the products that are affected in that regard appear in slide number 16. Yes. That shows the products that are affected. And that's in a nutshell my presentation. So in summary, it was just to set out the duties that are in place, the performance against reciprocal commitments, and on the reciprocal commitments, all I sought to explain was that of the 4.6 billion committed to, a certain amount has been spent, and in a non-confidential manner, I disclose that it's 1.6 billion, which represents 35% of the total commitment.
You will be engaging with us after July in greater depth on this matter. Right. Did you have your hand up earlier, Honourable Williams, followed by the Honourable MacPherson, the
Chairperson,
Honourable
Chairperson, can I just engage on this? Or I was out of the room. I don't know what you decided. Maybe we can't engage on this presentation, can we?
Engage on the presentation. The decision is that we said it is not acceptable to come here and at this meeting tell us, well, I can't disclose X. The protocol is to request a closed meeting, and then it is up to the chair to decide, and that wasn't done. But we said we would continue in for just a few minutes on what could be disclosed, and they will be returning after July. Yes, so you may go then, Honourable Williams, Honourable McLawbor, Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Clungwini. Right.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I just want to say that I think that the tariff of support that's been given to the downstream industry is very good. I must say, some of those tariff supports went from 0 to 30%, and that was pretty spectacular. But I just also want to know about the reciprocal commitments. I think that we should get this in writing as well from ITAC, what their sense of that is, because I feel that South Africa doesn't need to just pump money or put tariffs onto sections of society without there, you know, being something coming back to the state. We should have, you know, there should be value for our efforts, and so I would like that to be in writing as well. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, that's sweet. Thank you, Honourable McLawbor.
No, thanks, Chair. Mine is to request the team that Professor, when you come back on page 10, on page 10 there is bullet number 2 that make reference to the USA decision. If you can come back with more data, with respect, we know now that the percentage is 2%, which is the range in terms of the US market. But we have not actually spoken about the percentage of our own total capacity so that we can know. Because remember, ours is very insignificant. And the trigger there, because you might be wanting to put tariffs in, or rebates or reciprocal interventions, but in reality, it's very minimal. And you just advantage a sector in a particular way. The second bullet, the third bullet, is very fundamental, is what Comrade Hadebe was asking you. Subdued domestic steel demand due to subdued infrastructure spend and increasing cost, in bracket electricity, labor, and raw material. This is where the fundamentals are, around the efficiency, the productivity, and the growth of this thing. Is this the view of government, or is the view of experts, or is the view of India, and to what extent? Because if we are going to put tariffs, someone like the President of the US is putting this because he's worried about his own country. But in our case, we're also being made to actually pay rebates when we're actually not doing industrialization, beneficiation in terms of the downstream. This is one discussion when you even do as a commission, you do your own input and analysis. I thought, Chair, let me just raise only those 2 points, but the rest of the information looks very helpful.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Yes, Honourable,
Was it Lini? Thank you. Sorry. I want to call a point of order on you now. All right. Thank you, Chair. I think just going forward, Chair, I have no objection to some of the information in the presentation. Is very useful, and one needs time to go through it as well, and it can help when they are coming back. But what I want to propose is for the Steel Committee as well, to in that meeting that we have to also come, so that we can get this report that is so clearly confidential and get to the crux of it. But if some of the reports, I don't know what the rules are saying pertaining to that, we need to get some of these reports prior to the time so that we can peruse them, and then when they come, we have full information. Because sometimes it when the report comes late, it also depends on the type of questions that you want to ask and engage on and stuff like that. So I think that's why maybe also perhaps the root of the meeting this morning when is instead of West or something like that. And then I think he mentioned on, I think 1.4 billion, I'm not sure, 1.4 billion that was already invested. 1.6 billion that was already invested. If we can also be aware which companies was it in, where the money is invested, because we want to also see the triple B of this company that the money was invested in. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. That's the other one. But just before, Commissioner, if you would just ensure that your mic is switched off when you're not speaking. But I think you're making notes about what you will be required to return with as well. Okay? There was another hand just before you, Honourable Kacharya, was your colleague, the Honourable MacPherson, and then yourself. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I just wanted some clarity. Are we dealing with SARS after this, or are they going to do their own presentation? Okay, great. Just with respect to the reciprocal commitments and the pricing committee, these reciprocal commitments, to be perfectly frank, are vague. I think it's very important that we understand exactly what those that investment in plant and machinery actually resulted in. Because if you talk to people in the industry, ArcelorMittal are in fact actually producing less and more uncompetitive than they were to previously to this agreement. So I'd be interested to know how they're actually improving their competitiveness and production. When the minister or yourselves speak about pricing principles for the pricing committee, I'd like to know what are those principles, and I'd like them in writing, and when they were actually agreed to, and how those principles came to be. Because one of your in your reciprocal commitments is competitive prices. Now, in 2016, AMSA put up their prices 3 times in 1 year, yet the committee, as I understand, have only met twice since it was established. Is that correct? So how could they have put up their prices 3 times when the committee has only met twice in 1 year? And they based those price increases on, and I quote from a letter that the minister sent me, that it was based on the exchange rate weakening. Now, since then, the exchange rate has strengthened. Have they dropped their prices? Absolutely not. So there seems to be various reasons for increases, but never decreases. And I want to know, when will the price committee be meeting at the next time? Has the DTI put someone onto that price committee yet, and who is that person? And I would also like to understand when that investment detail will be made available to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Pichalia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like the questions addressed. I'd like to understand very clearly why government seems to protect what, to me at any rate, amounts to or seems to be an outmoded monopoly in terms of ArcelorMittal, and what exactly goes into that shoring up in monetary terms and what exactly it's used for. Secondly, to what extent, if you can quantify by separating the figures out, is this injection by way of support of ArcelorMittal at the expense of the downstream industry? I'd like you to apply your mind to that. And then, as my colleagues have all said very importantly, we'd like to get an idea as to the full extent of all commitments, particularly the reciprocal commitments, in great detail. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, members, I don't know if Honourable Hadebi, I did note, but I wasn't sure if you want, you've already spoken on the issue, if you didn't want to address it again. So, ITAC, it's just over to you. With respect to members of science and technology who may have just walked in, for the ordinary members, it's over here, but for the chairperson of that committee, if she will come up here, please. That is the Honourable Maseko. Would you just conclude, please, Mr. Mzimande?
Thank you very much. My understanding is that we return to the committee in writing to the questions that have been put to us. Thank you. We will do so.
And this time, adequate correspondence with myself as chairperson. I also have to work. I'm delegated powers by the Speaker, and effectively I need to communicate with her as well on such meetings. So it's not a light decision that's taken in Parliament, because we are a democratic institution and government, and essentially all our meetings should be open in Parliament. But we do accept that there are occasions when we may need to work within a closed meeting. And there are members in this committee who've had experience of working in committees where things are not as open as they may be in, say, industry. Can I leave it there? So they fully understand the rules. And you can hear the displeasure that was voiced by many, many members here. In fact, all parties who are present express their dissatisfaction. So I apologize to the members for that. I think we've done the best we can without wasting time and fruitless expenditure. What I'm going to ask everyone sitting here for the moment in the to just observe for a minute is, we had an exigency that arose with space. We had to put it on because we got a late invitation by the United Nations on this issue. So we had squeezed them in here, I want you to be able to remember your seat because they're only staying for 45 minutes to an hour, all right? So stay where you are and we will resume, and what we will resume with is EDD. EDD, you'd be ready, wouldn't you? And SARS. Right. So, just before I see a shooting up of hands, I just want to check with the committee secretary who's not here. He went to get water because members said there was no water. Right. Will you come forward with, well, that's fine where you are, as well as Dr. Mostert. I am taking the hands of the committee in a minute, Honourable Williams, all right? I just want to sort that side out. Right. Where there are three people who wish to speak. Honourable Williams, Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Flanguini.
Thank you, Chip. Chairperson, I'm a bit confused. Is not ITAC going to talk to us about the sugar industry now?
They will be talking to us after this, yes. We will go back. You will recall we actually had quite a, what shall I say, the first part of the meeting was not run that well. And we are behind time. And some people have only got half an hour for this item, which we have to have on the table. It's because members of Parliament are attending. Honourable MacPherson?
No, I'm fine as long as we can engage ITAC on the sugar tariffs.
All right. So nobody is excused from the room yet. So can we please, where are you, Ms. Nomfuneko? I can't see you. Oh, yes, you're down there. What are you giving us to work from? Or are you speaking to us? We don't want to waste any more time. Apparently there's a problem with power. The plugs aren't working. Is there any other plug? Is there any other plug? Well, the equipment has a problem now. Can I send you down to check that, please, Ms. Sheldon? Ms. Sheldon is the content specialist as well as I see an expert on this sort of thing. Can you please check?
All right,
we're not going to wait indefinitely. Can at least, let's start with Ms. Nomfuneko, let's see. Over here, we've got Ms. Nomfuneko Majaja, Chief Director, Advanced Manufacturing, EIDD. This is where the space industry falls. So Ms. Majaja, you can start without a presentation. Please start. And by the way, there's a co-chair here because the space industry, as you can imagine, there's a lot of research involved, science and technology, and on the other side, policy, as it were, trade and industry. So we have always, certainly since I've been chair, and Honourable Becky Khadebe worked with science and technology. So we'd like to welcome science and technology, but in particular, the chairperson, Honourable Maseko. Honourable, yes.
It's fine. I just want to just inquire, were all members of the Science and Technology Portfolio Committee invited to this meeting? Because it seems like
they were all. They were all. Certainly, staff were instructed to invite the committee through the committee secretary. And as late as yesterday, I was ensuring with Mr. Philander, the supervisor of this committee, that that would take place. The challenge they have, and I understand this, and I could be wrong, is no matter what time was chosen today, it would have been the wrong time and the wrong time this week. So they said they would have to go ahead. Is that correct, Honourable Maseko?
Good afternoon, Honourable Members, and everybody who's here. Yes, thank you. We were invited, although it was late, but Honourable Gordon Wolf and Honourable Dr. Tembe Gwayo are here as part of the committee. Some members are busy in other committees today. They were available this morning, but after 12 they were not available, and also there's one who is not well. Honourable Tuck is not well, but we are fine with the representation that is here. Thank you.
All right. On that note, can we ask Ms. Majaja to start? We really only have a short time for this briefing, Ms. Majaja. I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Chairperson and Honourable Members. We have a challenge with the technology, but I think the lady is saying it's coming now. Maybe I may start by introducing my colleagues that I'm with today. As you have mentioned, Chair, I'm with Dr. Medinas from UCT, who has been the previous chair of our council. Next to me, I'm with Dr. Val Monsami. Dr. Monsami is the CEO of SANSA. I'm also with my colleague from DST, Mr. Humulani Dau. So when this invitation came, I thought, let me mobilize my colleagues so that we can come here together, as this is an intergovernmental issue. Fortunately, we have the presentation up there. I'll do the presentation with Dr. Monsami. I'll start, and then towards the end, I'll hand over to him.
Go ahead. I see we all got copies, haven't we? Yes, hard copies. Right.
Just to apologize a bit there, Chair, we have added a few slides last night, and apologies to the chair of our council, Ms. Marupink. She couldn't be with us today. She had to go to Karoo as she worked for the FKA. So we have been communicating with her until very late last night. But the presentation hasn't changed much. I will look at a number of items in our presentation. Since we're coming here as the DTI and the FACSA, I'll briefly talk about the FACSA's mandate. I'll talk about the new legislation that is under draft. I'll talk to South Africa's participation in global space leadership. And then I will also talk to Unispace Plus 50, which is a huge event that is coming up next week, commemorating the first Unispace since 1968. Then I will talk about South Africa's participation within Unispace Plus 50. I felt it's necessary to start with how outer space is governed. As I think the members, we've been here quite a number of times, is governed under the United Nations Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. And this governance is through a number of treaties. There's basically five treaties that are governing outer space: the Outer Space Treaty, Rescue Agreement, Liability, Registration, and the Moon Agreement. South Africa is party to four of these conventions, except the Moon Agreement. And we're currently busy working on researching the pros and cons of ratifying the last one. So these five agreements are actually the binding instruments for the governance of outer space globally. Other than these binding instruments, there are voluntary commitments that countries decide and agree upon, like the transparency and the confidence-building measures, the principles and declarations. From those international instruments, we flow into what do we have as South Africa. South Africa, we are governed by the Space Affairs Act of 1993, the SANSA Act of 2009, the Non-Proliferation of Weapons of Mass Destruction, and the National Space Policy. These are the core treaties that I've alluded to in the previous slide. This slide talks to when was each of these treaties adopted, when did it come into force, and how many nations have ratified these treaties. We can see they started in 1966. The number of the countries ratifying these treaties, we've seen them diminishing, starting from 104 to 17, to the Moon Agreement that we have not ratified as well. These are the key principles, some key principles of the treaties. The treaties talk to space as a province of mankind. However, humanity has a shared interest in regulating activities of space. There has been a big push for outer space to be used for peaceful purposes, and no need for weaponization of space. And states have a primary responsibility for maintaining orderly conduct of their citizens. What has changed since the enactment of the treaties? We are seeing new topical issues coming into the space arena. Space mining, we are seeing space tourism, another new topical area. We are seeing a number of public interests that are involved within the UN corpus and the governance of space. We are seeing a lot of talk about maintaining peace and security. New actors, associations, industry, civil society, now they become part of this committee. A little touch on space mining, as this is a topical issue. According to Outer Space Treaty, outer space is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty by means of occupation or use by any other means, by any other...
Tlangwini, you're going to establish the EFF there.
Thank you, Chair. No, it's nothing of that sort. Chair, I'm just thinking, like, in terms of the pace that we're going and what time the meeting is ending, if the presenter can just move the speed up a bit, because we are sitting on a situation that we want to engage as the committee, as the sugar one as well, sorry. Not that the space part is not important, but like at the pace that we are going, won't finish anytime soon. So the presenter can just, and there are 31, 32 pages. So let's just move up.
You would do that, perhaps address the principles of the issue. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We'll try and pick up the speed. As I've mentioned, that there's another topical issue on space, which tends to blur between the outer space and the air space, and there is no clear consensus on this matter. Now, bringing these issues home,
We have what is known as the South African Council for Space Affairs, which is hosted by the DTI, appointed by the Minister. These are the members who were appointed in 2016. The council is established through that Act of 1993, which I've mentioned is the primary legislation of space in South Africa. The council is responsible for taking care of the interests and obligations of the state as far as the conventions and the treaties are concerned. They also mandate the minister to develop the national space policy, and this policy was developed in 2008. The national space policy in general is a guiding document, a framework that is guiding all space actors in the country as to how they should conduct themselves such that we can have peaceful use of outer space. Over and above National Space Policy of 1993, we are now looking at reviewing that legislation as it's actually very old, and there have been many developments within the country which requires us to take into consideration in the new legislation. We need to take into consideration the ratification of registration and liability conventions, which were done in 2009. Registration talks to us registering all our satellites going to space. Liability talks to us being responsible as a state for any damage that may occur as a result of our space project. There are a number of policies and strategies that we have managed to approve. Those, they need to be put into consideration. What is the scope of application of the new legislation? We're looking at covering a number of activities such as operation of a space facility, manufacturing of space objects, launching of space objects, operation and controlling those objects in orbit, re-entry of space objects from outer space, as well as space applications and exploration. These are the objects of the Act, which briefly talks to having the regulatory body continuing with the work and having a determined kind of a unit within the DTI. Now coming to Unispace Plus 50, which is probably the core that we're preparing ourselves for. As I've mentioned, Unispace Plus 50 is the 50th anniversary of the first Unispace, which took place in 1968. What is the history behind Unispace Plus 50? 1968, we had the first meeting raising awareness of the potential space benefits for all humankind. We had the second Unispace in 1982. Addressing how we should maintain outer space for peaceful purposes. Unispace Plus 3 in 1999 talked to us having to maintain human security, development and welfare, increasing participation of developing countries in space science and technology, and to see the benefits to that effect. What has South Africa done in preparation for Unispace Plus 50? We have had several workshops as the intergovernmental body comprising all the people that are here and therefore to try to come up with the South African agenda as to how are we going to contribute to Unispace Plus 50 and beyond. Beyond means Space 2030, which actually talks to how can we use space technology for socio-economic benefit. How could we use the applications of space for society? So after those several workshops, there was an international meeting in Vienna, which was finalizing the resolution. Then we had a preparatory meeting at DECO on the 4th of June, and we have constant communication with the embassy in Vienna. The following departments will participate within the Unispace Plus 50. This has been more of the preparatory work that we have been involved in with other nations.
We needed to just mention, Chair, that South Africa is within the global space leadership. The CEO next to me serves as the Vice President of the International Astronautical Federation for Developing Countries, the IAF, which is hosting the IAC every year in September, October. And South Africa hosted this event in 2011. It's one of the big space, aerospace events globally. The DSTDDG serves as a co-chair for GEO and the African Caucus. The
Ms. Majaja, do we have those slides? Because, you know, it appears as if we don't. Now, I'm not wasting time now to go and get them photostated, but this is what we have, and it does not include what the slides to which you are referring. Will you make them available to us tomorrow morning, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
We shall do that. Chair, we thought it's necessary to share this information because it means we have some form of clout that could help South Africa in feeding into these global institutions and bringing that back to South Africa. Within the Unispace Plus 50, South Africa will have an exhibition, a small exhibition space, which will only have a few marketing material that we will take along. The Unispace Plus 50 events are as follows. On the 18th and 19th, there will be a symposium which is aiming at bringing in the broader space community. There will be panel discussions that will take place on very topical matters, including space and industry, space and civil society, space and youth, which entails coming up with innovative ways to include youth, as well as Space for Women, which talks to the committee and the office looking at strengthening and empowering women in space and in STEM subjects. Then on the 20th to the 21st, we have the high-level session, which is the core of the session. Here there will be the opening and the statements from the incoming and outgoing chairs. Then there will be the opening of the high-level segment, and the high-level segment will be comprised of us looking at endorsing the Unispace Plus 50 resolution. The endorsement actually entails the member states still holding on to the treaties that I've alluded to beginning of the of my presentation. So it's actually firming up and emphasizing that we're still holding on to that. After this resolution or endorsement, the member states will have to make their statements, and the member states could make statements through the executive level, probably from the DTI or from the DST. However, the DM from the DTI will be part of this celebration. Chair, I will ask to hand over to my my CEO, Dr. Munsami, to continue with a slide that talks about sample certification within the Unispace Plus 50.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to be very quick, but I want to make one point just to bring space down to the earth, because I just wanted to capture the general interest. We're talking about the sugar industry. The sugar industry needs a space sector. So, for example, everybody in this room can see in what we call the visible spectrum. Okay. There's parts of the spectrum that you and I cannot see. Like, for example, you go and take an X-ray. The image that you get, you cannot see the X-ray, but you get an imprint of the bone structure, whether it's fractured or not. Likewise, there's certain parts of the spectrum that you cannot see, like the infrared. And that part of the spectrum gives us information about your agricultural production. How much of water is in the plant? Whether there's a disease that's coming up in the plant, before you actually see it in the visible parts of the spectrum. So with that information, farmers actually go and water the plant or fertilize the plant based on that information. So you actually rely on space information on a daily basis. So just wanted to make that connection. Just in terms of Unispace Plus 50 and UN Copious, there are four initiatives that we are currently working on from the SANZA perspective. You are aware that there's the BRICS Summit in July, and as the space agencies of the BRICS nations, we have come together to look at how do we cooperate with regards to space. And so there's a BRICS Space Cooperation Framework that we will be signing next week in Vienna, and that's to look at a virtual constellation of satellites as a first step. The second initiative is that we're working with a number of African countries to establish what we call the Committee of African Space Institutions. Now, the African Union is working to establish an African Space Agency, but one of the shortcomings of the approach is that we're not getting collaboration between African countries going. And this initiative is to get the space institutions in Africa to work together. And so there's about 8 countries on the African continent that will be signing a letter of intent to establish this Committee of African Space Institutions. And then we are looking at signing a bilateral MOU between SANZA and the Algerian Space Agency, and this is to look at collaboration in satellite development and some of the applications going forward. And sorry, I'm trying not to speak to the slide, I'll just speak off the cuff. And then the last one is on the IAF Global Conference for Emerging Countries. As my colleague has mentioned, the involvement of the IAF, there's a conference that we are planning for next year in Morocco called the Global Conference for Emerging Countries. And this is to capacitate emerging countries in terms of how do they establish sustainable space programs. And so there's a number of thematic areas that we'll be looking at next year. I'm just going to skip these few slides. And then just on the general highlights, in April this year, there was a send-off of Zakube 2. You recall that in August 2012, there was this launch of Zakube 1. Now, Zakube 2 is a small satellite, which is essentially the size of a loaf. And that's going to be helping us track the ship traffic along the coast. And then there's also another detector on the satellite that's looking at fire detection. And if this is successful, we'll look at a constellation of 9 satellites. On the space regulation side, we've issued a license for the satellite. Unfortunately, the satellite is delayed because of some issues with the launch vehicle itself. And as I said, it'll be a 9 constellation satellite if it's successful. Just some highlights, which you can read through here. I'm not going to go through that. And then on the Human Capital Development Program side, you might be aware that South Africa is host to the Pan-African University for Space Science, and we are looking at the first intake of students in January 2019. And the host institution is the Cape Peninsula University of Technology, and there's some other universities that will also be involved in the program. On the Space Science mission, the Minister of Science and Technology launched a upgraded Space Weather Center. And this center is the only center in the African continent of its kind. And it will be, we are actually positioning it to provide space weather information to all flights in and out of Africa because of the effects of space weather on aviation. And then my last slide is the Space Ops training. We were in Marseille last week, and which is a Space Ops conference. And this is the biggest conference of all space operators around the world that come together.
What's the name of it again?
It's Space Operations. And so South Africa will be hosting the next conference in 2020 here in Cape Town. Just the challenges of the space community, and I think some of the members of the various portfolio committees are aware of it, is the suboptimal funding for the National Space Program. And so what we are focusing on now as the agency and the government departments is looking at the financial sustainability of the space program, and then also looking at our stakeholder relations, because that's one of the mechanisms of trying to make ourselves sustainable is to work with other partners and share the cost appropriately. We're also looking at an upgrade of the assembly integration and testing facility, and that's still ongoing. But one of the aspects that we are currently working on with the Department of Trade and Industry and Science and Technology is an industry development framework, is to bring the industry into the sector. And so that's work that's already starting up as we speak. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I understood that Dr. Martinez was going to talk in the space as well. Is that correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable members, I was asked at short notice yesterday to join the delegation here to Parliament and just to provide some comments as an independent space expert. I'm very pleased to learn the progress that has been made towards updating the space governance situation in South Africa. Our space legislation, and we are one of the few countries that has space legislation, was quite progressive for its time among other things, suggesting that South Africa should be a responsible user of the outer space environment. And this is an issue that has become, that has come to the fore over the last decade or so as countries begin to recognize that the outer space environment on which we rely so heavily, as my colleague Dr. Monsami just explained, that environment is actually a limited natural resource. It sounds somewhat counterintuitive, but you have to realize that this is the orbital environment around the Earth that we use for satellites that deliver many, many services to people on the ground that we all rely on every day of our lives. So the upcoming Unispace Plus 50 symposium is an opportunity for the world space community to reflect on the effectiveness of space governance. The current international framework that we use was developed during the Cold War when there were only two major actors in the space arena. Nowadays, the situation is very different. There are well over 80 countries that are active in outer space, and the space actors are no longer just states, but also a large number of non-state actors. And so global space governance is an area that needs attention, and Unispace Plus 50 will be the first global space summit of the 21st century that will look at the existing treaty framework and how that can be applied in a way that we can continue to benefit from space, not only for the current generations, but also the future generations. There are some emerging issues that I think South Africa should take particular attention of, and this is the growing number and diversity of space actors, and this presents opportunities for us to develop our capabilities, both through collaborations, as Dr. Monsami mentioned in his presentation, but it also creates opportunities to develop our advanced manufacturing sector, which can then support and uplift the rest of our industry and make it more competitive and capable. And then finally, one other area that I want to draw attention to is the growing international interest in what's called space resource utilization. This is a development that stems from the growing commercial uses of outer space, and simply put, it is that the sphere of human economic activity is expanding off the surface of this planet out into space, and a new legal paradigm is being developed. And so I think it's important for South Africa to be part of those international discussions so that when the rules of the road are made, we're part of those discussions, and we will not be placed at a disadvantage in future years as those technologies are rolled out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, and certainly thank you to Ms. Mujaja for, you know, getting the team together. I noticed, though, that there were a couple of other names here. Mr. Mark Reinhardt, is he here?
Chair, Mr. Reinhardt could not join us this morning, but Mr. Mdao from DST is here at the far end. Maybe you would like to say some few words.
Would you like to comment, make any points? Is it Mr.
Mdao? Thank you, Chair. I really don't have much to add. Thank you.
Now, this is the brief presentation on Unispace 40 and the related issues around that, which are important. And I think members can engage at this moment, noting that we also have the co-chair here for this section Chairperson Maseko. So whoever is here from these two committees should engage. So we've got Honourable McLaubo, Honourable Williams, anyone down there? No? Yes? Honourable Khadebe. Chair, you need to also speak as and when. Yes.
No, thank you very much, Comrade Co-Chairs, and thanks to the team on the presentation. We must welcome it. And it's an important piece of work, and the news that in the next few days you'll be part of the global community signing as BRICS countries. There is only one issue apart from the good work we are doing around looking at the space for human development and other aspects. Never make a mistake to forget the security implications. They have not actually subsided, they've actually escalated. The prof is correct now. The question of state and non-state actors' activities over the last few years have increased in the outer space. And, probably same time, also speak to guys who are working in the security cluster. I will not go into details, but there are certain countries who are using the space, one for military purposes, but also for economic advantage. And you could see the number of satellites that have been planted at a very highest level that you cannot be able to detect, where your country remains under a microscope, if I may use that. Don't downplay that particular element and only be more worried about science, innovation, invention. There's a big thing that are happening there. The guys who used to work together, at least those guys in BRICS, they will tell you more. If you go in there, speak to them, they will tell you more what's happening in our outer space, and we don't have all the data because of the capability we have. That's the only comment, Comrade Kocher, I thought I must raise, because I could see the element moving away from military, what. The world has changed. The Cold War never subsided. It took a different form. Took a different form, but the actors, they use other spaces and platforms to do certain things. That space is the most active space. But for people who are not having the know-how, they think everything is cool there. The reality is not. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Williams, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just have one question on page 8, slide 8. It talks about space mining and that although you can't, outer space is not subject to national appropriation by claim or sovereignty. I just want to know, this finder's keepers, does that mean that if we focus our square kilometer satellite onto the furthest galaxy at the end of the edge of the universe and we can prove it's there, does that mean that it's ours because we found it? Or does it mean we actually have to put somebody standing on that and that is very disadvantaged to us because the countries that have got the technology can eventually be sending people to Mars and say, we landed first, it's ours. You know, so I just want some clarity on that finders keepers clause or whatever. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Khadebe. There are a few more hands that came up. Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Kachalia.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, Honourable Matlova has actually left on what I wanted to say. In particular, when the forecast is going to make the space not for weaponization purposes. Actually, what is actually happening out there? If anyone is going to be in control of space, is going to be in control of the world. So I think that I'll have to warn the South Africans that you cannot have a situation whereby we ratify ourselves out of the game. We know very well that, as we are speaking today, Chair, the biggest economy in the world is meeting one of the smallest economies in the world because of what it is in possession of that country. If that country didn't have that, there's no need for that. So what I'm emphasizing, Chairperson, is that in our enthusiasm to be democratic, to be responsive, we must not paint ourselves into a corner, so that at the end of the day, we are not able to defend the very same country we are speaking about. So, in more important aspects, that are we having adequate research and funding to maintain our participation in that area? Because if we don't do that, and then these issues which we are raising now will fall far, far behind, and then we regret it at the end of the day. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Kadebe, Honourable McPherson, followed by the Honourable Kachalia.
Thank you. The Honourable McLaughlin has just pricked my interest in something. And I'd like to know, has the agency had anything to do previously with assisting military intelligence under the code name Condor and Flute to produce satellites in conjunction with the Russian Space Agency? If you have had any interaction on either of those two projects, I'd like the details. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Kachalia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Honourable Moslova also pricked my interest in that. When he mentioned, and I think quite properly mentioned, the importance of space technology in the security cluster, if you like. And with regard to that, I'd be interested to know what we as South Africa, what international protocols or treaties are we potentially, have we signed or are we considering signing that will protect the freedom of and individual rights of people in our country as opposed to granting blanket surveillance to state organizations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Honourable Kachalia. And looking further down, I'm also inviting, if the co-chair wants to come in at this point, Chairperson Maseko.
Thank you very much, Chair Fabs. And Honourable Member, thank you very much for the presentation. Very interesting that after Honourable Matlobo spoke, then there was a pricked some interest. But I just want to find out on page 5. Well, first, I do want to say that I think this is one entity that must come back to science and technology, and I saw the lack of interest from members of trade and industry when the presentation was about to be made, and Honourable Ntlangwini was a representative of the committee interest. So I think we do say that some of these entities don't find enough space in trade and industry. If you are presenting to science and technology, you would have had the whole time to yourself to present and take questions and respond and what have you. So now we have to rush. But on page 5, the core treaties, I just want to interest on out of how many there's the number of ratifying states, like this 104, 94, 92, 63, and 17 on the, and it's out of how many, 104 out of how many, and then the agreement governing the activities of states of the moon and other celestial bodies, it's to find out what is the problem, why is it since 1979 only 17 that have ratified. And I think probably other countries have taken heed of the issues that were raised by Honourable Mashaw on that. But I also wanted to raise something, Chair. I think the presentation that was sent to us is just a fraction of what was presented. So if you could have the full presentation, and I think it disadvantages you in engagement, because most of the things we're presenting on, we do not have on slides. And this is one funny room that doesn't have a monitor that is facing the chair so that you can also follow. And lastly is the members raised also the issue of we need adequate funding for this, also including research and development thereof. The view of the committee that has been pushing and in line with the NDP is that you need 1.5% of the country's GDP, and we are only sitting at 0.74 as a country. So the lack of funding also comes from there. So the issues that were raised and the level of security that you need to look at while we research and develop also depends on that particular funding. And what we have realized as a committee, portfolio committee, is that a lot of some of the of the research that we do have to undertake have funded outside, and if they are funded by international donors, they call the tune. And unfortunately, you can't do anything because you don't have your own money. So it is just to inform the committee, it is very important that all of us help in ensuring that this we do reach at least the minimum of 1.5% of the country's GDP for research and development. And what we have also realized is that most departments, if they have to shift and rearrange their APPs, the first item that has to suffer is R&D. So we are also pushing for to have a separate vote on R&D so that it is centralized and we know what's happening to you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thank you once again for inviting us to this. And I think we in our committee, what is important is that we are one country, we are one government, and we need to complement each other. We do not need to be competing against each other. We need to complement each other. So I think when presentations like this do take place, any other committee that is affected, we need to come together as joint committee, saving resources and time. Thank you. But I think space must come to science. Thank you.
No, Chairperson Maseko, you're quite right. We ourselves wanted to give it 2 hours, but we tried to accommodate so many things. It's always the case when you come to the end of a particular quarter, as it were, particularly this one. But just one thing one would like to get a little bit more on, you know, outer space governance. Outer space governance is becoming increasingly more important. And if we could just get a perspective on that, and I think the points have already been made around the treaties, that we must appreciate what is the impact of those treaties on our own developmental state. Before readily signing, we need to unpack it. And it is becoming the future, and all of us must take a deeper interest in this field. Having said that, can we turn to Ms. Majaja, who made this time available to us? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. I'll start with the treaties and probably the comment from the Chair for Science and Technology that as government departments, we must complement each other. And Chair, I think we have really displayed that complementing each other here today by bringing everybody on board. And Chair, just to emphasize that most of the space is within science and technology. The Chief Directorate under Mr. Mdau is Space, Science and Technology. SANSA CEO next to me is under science and technology. The only unit left within the DTI is the regulator. SANSA is implementing the space program under the guidance of the DST. And within the DTI, we're doing the work of regulating the space industry. And it was felt that the implementer and the regulator can't be under one roof, because you would be able to be the referee and the player in that kind of a scenario. So rest assured, Chair, most space function is within DST. Now I'll start just with the treaties, as it's an area that talks to us as the DTI and the Council. The Chair asked, why is the level of treaties under which are being ratified is dwindling as we starting from the Outer Space Treaty going downwards. As you have seen, as I've mentioned, there are a number of countries that are member states. There are 194 states that are part of the UN Corpus, and some of the countries have ratified most of the treaties. Some have ratified four, like ourselves, and I believe probably my colleagues will assist here that as far as the Moon Treaty is concerned, there hasn't been a lot of interest and probably misunderstanding about what does the treaty entail. That is why many countries are not ratifying the treaty. As I've mentioned, as South Africa, we are looking at ratifying that treaty, but we are undertaking research. As one member has mentioned here, that you don't just ratify, you need to understand what would be the implications of ratifying this treaty. So we need to understand the implications first before we can ratify. And once we have made that determination, we'll come here to the Parliament and say, this is what we have found out, and we believe we must ratify this treaty. But as Dr. Martinez has mentioned, and I also mentioned in the presentation, the mineral resources or mining on the moon is becoming a topical issue as a result of commercial interest and public interest. So South Africa doesn't want to be left behind in that discussion. Hence, it's important that we must be in the discussion. We must ratify the treaty. However, we will be led by what is the standpoint from the research. I just want to touch on another question that relates to whether the treaties are sort of ratifying these treaties are sort of opening up to a number of issues, especially for the ordinary citizens on the street. I must say, as far as all the treaties that we have ratified, especially the Liability Convention, is actually trying to protect the men on the street, to protect the property and the citizens of South Africa, because the Liability Convention talks to the state accepting liability. So as the state is accepting liability, the state must be able to guide who pays for some form of insurance to cover for any damage or any eventual damage that may occur. So the state is doing that such that the space activities or the launching of activities is not done willy-nilly without the state knowing what is happening, and the state must put into place some guiding measures, must put into place mechanisms to ensure that in the eventual occurrence of whatever, whoever has been affected can be able to have a discourse. I think I will end there so that my colleagues can take other questions.
Just give your name for the record.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Val Munzami. I'm just going to touch on the issue of the security aspect of space. And I think we must just be careful as well, because military applications does not necessarily mean non-peaceful use of space. Just to give an example, everybody uses a GPS on their phone. That started off as a military application, but it's now used by the civilian sector. In terms of the protection from the South African side, we have a sister council called the Non-Proliferation Council for the Weapons of Mass Destruction, and that act regulates the import and export of dual-use technology. So there are technologies that go into a satellite segment, as an example, that can go into a defense system as well. So any non-state actor who wants to get access to some of this technology has to apply through the DTI for import-export permits. The other aspect is through the Council of Space Affairs. There's an indication of the space institutions are expected to register with the Council in terms of what their activities are. And I think this will be hardwired into the revised act that's coming at the moment. So that's just to see who's doing what in the space landscape. And we should also mention that South Africa is party to the Mossad Technology Control Regime, the Wassenaar Group. So we are abiding by those international norms as well in terms of regulating the activities of non-state actors. And then I think on the Kondo and I think it's the flute, SAMSA does not deal with the military. There's a defense intelligence because of state security, because we're a civilian space program. Okay. And we service the needs of government departments, whether it's environment, fisheries, and so on. So I think ArmsCorps is the procurement arm of defense, and they deal with the space issues, not SAMSA. So we separate from defense in that respect.
I'm glad you clarified that. Is it Martinez? Are you coming in?
Thank you, Chair. Just very briefly to add to the very comprehensive responses of my colleagues. Again, since there was an interest expressed by several members on this security question, absolutely, this is a very important issue, because we're finding that security on Earth is being increasingly underpinned by security in outer space, and that's why these global space governance discussions are so important. And we talk about the three S's, that's it's security, sustainability, and safety. All of those issues are very closely interlinked, and within the UN system, they are dealt with under separate committees of the UN, which has in the past been a kind of stovepiped way of treating peaceful uses of space and the security uses. But even within the UN system, there's now growing interaction between these two previously separate discussions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Majaja, is there? Yes, thank you. Is that science and technology down there? Yes. Yeah, Mr.
Chair, thank you very much. I also just wanted to highlight that on the security part and intelligence, that as government, we are putting much more great effort together with the State Security Agency, with defense and other relevant government departments such as DTPS and transport, to ensure that that security aspect, as we implement our space program, is taken care of. As you would know, that most of the highly successful spacefaring nations, that the greater investment or more investment has been from defense and security, and therefore it is critical that as government that we work very closely with intelligence, defense, and security. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, members, you know what, this is just a short bite at it. In the past, we've given it several hours, but we don't have the same luxury this time with several bills on the table. But I do want to, nevertheless, thank Ms. Majaja for, you know, endeavouring to ensure that at least we address this before the end of this quarter. I think next time we must work together in a manner, if there is a next time, as it were, perhaps after August, in which you return to us with what has occurred in Vienna, and both committees can effectively engage for an hour and a half to 2 hours. All right. And I think we'll pull that together more effectively at that time, because we would have processed one of the bills by that point, and we will have more time. But I do want to thank my colleague as well, the chairperson of Science and Technology. She's passionate about these areas, especially research and development. And I think trade and industry needs to encourage more research and development in our own mandate, etc. But I do want to thank you, Ms. Majaja, and your team and your colleagues. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity.
Yes. Now, members of trade and industry, we are adjourning for lunch just over here. If you walk out the main door, as I sit, you turn left. You see, so through those doors, I would turn left and come back right here on this side. But all these doors are locked. We are coming back at 1:30, 1:25 to 2 at the latest. Well, they can science and technology, but I mean it's about tariffs. Oh yes, lunch is a different matter. I'm already on to the hour. But members of science and technology are welcome to join us. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.